listened to the public testimony. I don't expect I would have heard anything to change my mind. Actually, Rita told me I didn't have to abstain on it.
Mic on?
But once I had sort of said,
okay, we're going to start in just a minute.
I'm going to do that, and I didn't want to
about with regard to the marine environment before we kick off the session. We have two key things for tonight. One is on the topic of the marine protected areas, what's being done to educate the public about those areas, and Rita Bunzel is here to describe that for us. And then the second is, how are the MPAs serving as a research tool to help evaluate the health of the oceans from a fisheries perspective in the collaborative fisheries research? We had planned to have a discussion, as you recall from our last meeting, about wave energy, and it turns out that some of the key presenters for that were not available at this meeting. They will be available at the next meeting. So that's why we sort of switched the program. But it actually fits sort of hand in glove here, because we're talking about the same areas and how these areas now can help resource managers better manage the fisheries and get us good scientific information. So it'll be an exciting evening. I just want to kick off the session by sharing news with the public and with the Marine Interest Group that I'm really excited that Dean Wendt, Associate Professor of Biology at Cal Poly, has earned the Distinguished Scholarship Award at Cal Poly. There are only two of these given out each year, one in the sciences and one in the humanities. Dean earned that award this year for really the outstanding work he's done in many areas, but heavily in the work that's been done with and through the Marine Interest Group and the resources that he's brought intellectually and organizationally to bring the success. So it's just a phenomenal thing, Dean, that you've earned this. We're just so thrilled for you. We have a bottle of champagne for you to enjoy. Enjoy with your family. And but as everybody who's been tracking this knows, Dean has really put his shoulder to the wheel here, providing the academic, scientific, and even more than just academic and scientific, really sort of leadership resources and capabilities to carry this forward and to make this area known now as it is, as one of the primary areas of research and advancement in the understanding of the oceans and how to work with them in a practical way. So, Dean, congratulations. So that's a big award. Everyone wanted to share their greetings with you about that.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it very much. And Don, I sort of knew that you would. Well, I didn't know you would go quite this far, but you're always pushing me. So again, every area, thank you. I thank all of you. I really do feel like this.
Sorry to interrupt. It's good to join by.
Obviously, I didn't prepare anything here, and it's sort of like my wedding again. But anyway, it all started. A lot of the direction that my career has taken started right here with this group in 2002, and so it's been very pleasurable for me and rewarding to see my career and my research change and my role as a scientist change through the interactions with this group and the community. And so I thank all of you for giving me the opportunity to do what I do. So thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you. So let's begin here with PJ. PJ, do you have a quick update that you'd like to offer? Again, you have to turn the microphone on because of the cable TV.
Okay, there we go. PJ Webb, I am the at-large representative on the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council. We just finished our annual symposium. It was April 18th up in Monterey, and it was a fascinating presentation of current research. And the theme was Back to the Future, Preserving the Sanctuary by Exploring Its Past. And we had wonderful presentations on pollutants. We had presentations on the Elkhorn Slough Tidal Wetland Project. We had presentation on Second People Meet the First People, Early Spanish Explorers Encounter Native People, which was fascinating. There's a lot of archaeology sites that are in the intertidal area that we're probably are going to lose to the rising sea level. So that's that's an area that we're going to lose our history if we don't get more archaeological digs going. A review of the commercial and recreational fisheries in the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary from 1983 to 2007. That was fascinating as well. And then the keynote was by Dr. Bruce Robeson, who presented his Heroes of Future Past, Deep Pelagic Research in Monterey Bay, which was also fascinating. You could go to the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary website and look up the symposium. We have this every year, and I'd love to share any information if anyone wants to get an update on any particular individual item. There are also poster presentations, everything from junior high to high school students to college students to professional biologists. So it's packed with information about the ocean and conservation.
So it'll be available to the public. Weather and swells have been especially favorable the last few days, last week, maybe, last few days. We've been able to get several boats in and out of our boatyard, and there has not been that opportunity for about 3 months. So that small thing has become very significant as well. For the May opening, our new restrooms, showers, and laundry facilities, that's part of the new sport launch. Has been funded by California Department of Boating and Waterways, and that'll be available to the public on the 1st. The bid documents for the Lighthouse Road, restoration of the Lighthouse Road, were open today. So by the middle of May, that project will be going forward. And the diesel line. With the help of the Joint Cable Fisheries Liaison Committee, is moving forward. It's been almost a year since the diesel line out to the end of the pier has not been usable because it sprung a leak. And the fishermen are very anxious for us to get that back online so that we can begin to sell diesel in the more economic, be able to buy it more economically and sell it at a much better price to them. So that's it. We're looking forward to a good season. And I'll go on to Mel.
My name is Mel DeLamont. I'm represent recreational fishermen, and I'm also the president of the Central Coast Fisheries Conservation Coalition. Can't think of anything to report. Very interested in hearing Ms. Benzel's report tonight.
And I'm Bruce Gibson. I'm the second district supervisor representing the north coast of San Luis County. I guess two activities within county government of interest. One is last week at our board meeting, the board passed a letter of comment to Secretary of Interior Ken Salazar opposing offshore oil drilling in waters off the San Luis Obispo County coast. And the vote was 3-1 with Supervisor Ashajian recusing himself because of his business interests with oil companies. The other is that the Los Osos wastewater project goes to the Planning Commission tomorrow, or at least starts its way through the permitting and public hearing process, and that's been the culmination of over 3 years of work by county staff, and the result is a 300-page staff report, a 5,000-page EIR, and a lot of discussion yet to occur, but we're very excited that we are seeing we're seeing the start of something happening on that long delayed initiative.
Hello, I'm Janice Peters, City of Morro Bay, and on the wastewater topic, we'll continue along there. We're doing things to create awareness with the Cayuga Samoa Bay JPA for our sewer treatment plant. We're trying to create awareness of, you shouldn't flush your cat litter. So we have this little poster. trying to get it so it shows the camera, and this is saying, you know, an embarrassed cat found out his owner was flushing his mush. We don't want mush flushed. So we have several of these. I'm happy to hand them out if you have any place that you could post it. It is very eye-catching, and it's been very effective. It really makes people think. So poor embarrassed cat. So if I have those available, if any of you would like them for your business or anywhere else that you could post them. Rick Algert and I went to Washington with the CMANC group, the Harbors and Ports of California, and had some very, very good results this time. It's been very difficult getting the harbor maintenance tax used for the purpose it was intended. It's always been used just to balance the budget without any of it being spent where it was supposed to be spent. So we did actually get a commitment from Senator Boxer this time that she is going to look into that and getting that money out there with all the stimulus money flowing and everything. That's a good time to catch up on our harbor maintenance. It means that we may get our back bay dredged for the first time in 7 years, which would be delightful. We get the harbor entrance channel dredged regularly thanks to Representative Capps and others, but that back bay, down to the back bay, has not been done in quite a while. So that was very positive. And also, at the same time that we were there, we were speaking to a number of agencies about our fishing collaborative efforts. And with the Nature Conservancy, we spoke to the
Central Coast Watersheds Program. And I wanted to just briefly tell everyone that we are holding our second annual Coast and Ocean Regional Roundtable on June 4th. And actually, I learned today that Dean Wendt is going to be our keynote speaker in the morning session. So I'm really pleased about that, because it will be an opportunity, once again, to help everyone see the good work that SLOCI is doing, but also demonstrate the importance and values that this community and this area has for understanding the critical links between our coastal areas, coastal communities, and the marine environment. Our CORT project, which is Coast and Ocean Regional Roundtable for short, is really an effort to bring together watershed, coastal watershed groups that are engaged in watershed management and coastal stream restoration, together with marine conservation groups, as well as the resource agencies that are involved with those managing those areas, to consider the important steps that need to occur to integrate the management of coast and ocean resources. So it's been in our second year. We've found that our issues are still we have issues yet to define, and so we are really working hard to come up with a set of important issues that we can focus on. There's so many things that need to be addressed, but we hope we will bring to you not only speakers from out of the area, but raise awareness and define some of the issues as they occur here locally. So that will be our purpose on June 4th. And that's it.
Thank you. Dan?
Good evening. My name is Dan Berman. I'm the director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, and I have a number of updates. The Estuary Program awards grants to partner organizations that help implement our management plan for the Bay and Watershed. And at our last round of meetings, we approved a number of grants, including $75,000 to the City of Morro Bay to help deal with some of the derelict vessels in the estuary, trying to get them out before they sink. One sank just last week, this last week. Thankfully, it was one that didn't have much on it in terms of pollution to the bay, and the city, you know, reacted quickly and I think has it out of the water already. It's getting there. It's off the bottom at least. I suspect we may soon find out that that's where some of our grant money is going to go. We also gave a couple more science-focused grants, one to look for black rails, which is a bird that utilizes the estuary or has been known to utilize the estuary in the past. It's not listed as a Federal Endangered Species Act, but it is extremely rare in the state. We're not quite sure if they're still here in the bay at all or not. So that was a grant to the Audubon Society to do a comprehensive survey and try and see if they're still present here. And then a small grant as well to support some of the work that the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance is doing, specifically the research on chemicals that seem to be associated with fish tumors in the estuary. So we're trying to help bridge a sort of gap in the funding for that work. I also submitted an application to NOAA for a coastal training. It's essentially kind of a planning, a workshop that NOAA will come and do in coastal counties that for related to planning in the coastal zone to try and prepare, you know, for sea level rise, thinking about watershed work and trying to get local government and planning agencies thinking about coastal protection. So I'm waiting to hear back if we got that or not. If we did, we'll be looking to this group and other groups to try and fill that session up. The ASTEROID program, since I've last been at this meeting, we did another riparian fencing project in the watershed, fenced a couple miles of a creek that had really chronic high bacteria levels downstream, and we've fenced out, working with private landowners, fenced the cattle out of the creek for a pretty significant reach of the creek, and it's sort of anecdotal still at this point, but we got, after a site that downstream that had violated water quality standards for years, the months after the fencing went in, it immediately started meeting water quality standards. And then just the most recent sample we got that was high again, and we went upstream, and there had been some sort of miscommunication. The cattle had been in the creek again, so we've got our little mini experiment going on that seems to suggest that, at least on this ranch, we really have done something that's improving water quality. And I guess on that same note, I was at a meeting at the Regional Water Board today, and they do they have a process that actually happens across the country where, based on monitoring data, they designate waters as either impaired, meaning they're not meeting water quality standards, or not impaired, still to be done. So I think that's it.
Just one thing I want to follow up on, Dan. We especially appreciate your efforts on bringing together a large number of players for that application on the NOAA coastal training activity. I think this is a good illustration of how this Central Coast area is putting itself forward as a can-do community of collaborators and multiple interests that can move forward important things, and your efforts in that regard were a good example of that, and we're hopeful that that'll really bear fruit, because one of the things we want to do is be able to get county planners, city planners, and others engaged more around the marine issues. They typically think terrestrial, but a lot of the things have, as Monica was highlighting, these cross connections. So we're trying actively to figure out how we can extend the collaboration and the successes here and continue to be a model for how to do this.
Well, and I want to thank Henry Pontarelli, who just showed up, who actually did more of the heavy lifting than I did on getting that application done, which was great, because you were talking about government planners. He was coming at it from a private business planning firm's perspective, which was really valuable as well.
Okay, great. Patricia.
Yes, Patricia Wilmore, Governmental Relations, Pacific Gas and Electric Company. I'll mention a couple things. This Saturday is our annual Earth Day volunteer effort, and this goes on throughout the state with PG&E employees and others leading activities. And in this county, we contribute our time, money, and effort to Montana De Oro State Park, and we'll be rebuilding trails and cleaning trails and that kind of thing this Saturday from 8 until 1. And at pge.com, you can volunteer for that. I believe there are still some slots available. It's fascinating. As I look at our website, these events do, if you will, sell out throughout the state, where people are that eager to come out and help our state parks and other worthy activities. Secondly, the Port San Luis Harbor District was successful in getting a grant from PG&E for $18,000+ to be used for an electric vehicle to patrol the district. So that is, I think, a very good thing. And finally, we do have in mind and have secured the services of our wave energy expert, Hal LaFlash, to be here next October 14th. And with a name like HaloFlash, you know, he had to go into the energy business, I guess.
No doubt about that.
Yeah.
Good choice.
Good choice.
And then we'll turn to Henry for his update.
Sure. Dean Wendt, Cal Poly, Director of San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance. A couple of brief updates. One is that we had a SLOC advisory committee meeting on, I think it was the 25th of March, about a month ago. And during that meeting, the main agenda item was the presentation of a couple of years of data that we've been collecting on access to the Rocky Intertidal Zone, actually on PG&E property. We've been working with folks at Cal Poly and Tenera Environmental to do a controlled study looking at the effects of access in the Rocky Intertidal. And so that was a very informative advisory committee meeting. You guys heard about this the last time. We developed a formal management action memo, which is based on that research, which has now been delivered to State Parks, CDFG, and the Coastal Commission, or it's going to be going to them. And if anybody is interested to see the results of that and what that management action memo says, you can get it at our website, www.sloc.org. Another brief update, I'm going to be talking about the collaborative research and the sampling that we've done over the last couple of years. I'm very pleased with that entire program, but I'm also happy that last night I came home from a review in Monterey that was very similar to what we're going to be doing here tonight. And I got an email from an editor at the American Fisheries Society Marine and Coastal Fisheries Journal, and they have accepted a manuscript that I wrote with Rick Starr based on the protocol and the program, which is entitled Collaborative Research, an Effective Way to Collect Data for Stock Assessments and to Evaluate MPAs in California. So it's nice. That's now getting into the academic literature as well, and so that's a big positive. And then I'll have more later.
Just additional evidence of why you earned the Distinguished Scholarship Award for the year from Cal Poly. So Henry, did you
and work with that board of harbor commissioners in Port San Luis to create a really exciting project that's going to nod to the harbor district and to the community and build an environmentally and economically sustainable development in Port San Luis. A request for qualifications. So it's a process in which the Harbor District is collecting statements of qualifications from interested and qualified parties to enter into an exclusive right to negotiate to delineate what that project is going to what the project is going to look like. So it's a pleasure working with the Harbor District. We are doing some economic impact assessment work and related to the commercial fisheries when the results of some of that analysis is ready, we'll bring it to the advisory council, to the MIG. We've also received a challenge from the Water Board to strengthen the AB 162 component and our housing element updates. AB 162 has to do with building in floodplains and stormwater runoff. So we're working closely with the Regional Quality Water Board here, and we've started a relationship with Santa Clara Valley Water District, who's kind of gone before us on this issue. Very interesting stuff. Our firm has just been granted a contract to do a economic development strategy in Moss Landing. So now we're working in the commercial fisheries in San Diego, Morro Bay, and Moss Landing, so kind of building on this dream to be working up and down the coast and be able to speak in a broad sense regarding the fisheries and what's going on and how we might move forward.
Okay, great. Thanks, Henry. I just have two quick updates on actions that the Marine Interest Group took at the last meeting. You recall that there were two things in particular that you asked for action on. One was to request the Pacific Fisheries Management Council to support community fishing associations so that areas like Morro Bay and Port San Luis would have the opportunity to retain some allocation of fishing opportunity and to do that in a collective basis for enhanced stewardship and more effective economics. I presented that on behalf of the MIG at the Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting, and I was very pleased to note that several people talked about that topic, including the San Francisco Fishing Organization. But immediately after those presentations, the council took an unscheduled action to endorse including community fishing associations in the plan going forward. So I want you to know that the things that you're doing here, and they were actually were very interested in what we were doing and what the framework was and what the viewpoints were of this you know, multi-stakeholder group and putting that forward, because obviously they get lobbied all the time by individual stakeholders, but they rarely get sort of a collective voice. So it was very powerful, very impactful on them, and several of the members of the council came up to me afterwards and said, glad that you were here. This is important to get attention. We understand this issue better now because you're helping to explain it. So wanted to know you had good action there. The second item that you took action on was to send a letter with your concerns about plastic debris, particularly plastic bags, et cetera, and the impact on the marine environment that that has, both to the San Luis Obispo Integrated Waste Management Organization, sort of a regional one here, as well as to our state representatives. And I'm pleased to note that this has now become a topic of the Ocean Protection Council, and they tomorrow are going to be taking action on this topic to begin to move the state away from the current patterns of plastic debris problems that exist by coming up with innovative incentives and opportunities to reduce that source of troubling pollution. So there again, I forwarded your letter on to the Ocean Protection Council because they always look at who is supporting taking action on these items, and the letters do make a difference. In fact, they call us and say, hey, does the Marine Interest Group have something to say about this? Because that makes a difference to how they act. So I wanted you to know the two things that you took action on last time got traction, things are moving, you're making a difference. So we'll see what comes up tonight and how to carry it forward from here.
Can I just add on to that? I happen to be working at home today and saw Oprah.
State legislation is going to go, but interestingly, our executive officer of the IWMA reports that at least within the city of San Luis Obispo, apparently there's a Chamber of Commerce did a survey of some sort or another that identified a huge support for banning plastic bags within the merchant community. And so we're working on the possibility of bringing forward a voluntary action, sort of make it culturally desirable to ban those particular items. And that and the regulatory will keep moving forward together.
So you may end up having a poster like Janice's you could put up about.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. The shame of plastic,
shame of plastic bags,
which means I have to remember to take my reusables into the store.
right. Okay, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, Don, I'd like to include a little bit on this particular subject. The Harbor District has in the past asked the restaurants in Avila Beach to not use styrofoam containers, to not use styrofoam cups and those kinds of things. And as the years go by, it loses traction, and so we need to pick it up again. But what we have done is to begin to include a prohibition on plastics in our new leases as we write new leases. Mm. So that's one of the conditions of lease, and when that is, the first one will come to us Tuesday night, and after that we'll be able to go to our restaurants and then to the Business Association in Avila Beach and ask for their voluntary cooperation on this very important issue. So it's for us, it's starting small, but we have to teach by example, and so we're starting with our leases, and we'll go on from there.
Good. Okay.
If I may add to Bruce's anecdote, I was present at that Good Morning San Luis Obispo, which the Chamber does monthly, and there was a fabulous skit from a couple of Cal Poly students about plastic and some of the hazards and what other countries do. And afterward, we did a green card, red card survey of all present, and over 200, about 220 present. And, you know, do you think something should be done? A yes was green, a no was red, and there were probably three reds in that whole crowd, mm-hmm. which was extremely encouraging.
Okay. Well, I want to move on to our main activities this evening, but it's I'm finding at each of these sessions the discussion about what you're all doing collaboratively is getting richer and richer. But we want to be sure to move on to our main topics for broader discussion here. And that is, we've got the MPA Update and Education Program. Rita Bunzel, who's the MPA Education and Outreach Initiative Director. Actually, someone whom I've known, I guess, for about 3+4 years, somewhere in there, who has been active in the marine research area, has been doing videography about the marine world, has been looking at and how we can educate and provide more information to the public about the marine areas. So she's going to talk about what she's been involved with there and share some of the videos and other materials. And part of the discussion we want to have with the MIG afterwards is, what do you see as some opportunities, whether it's ecotourism connections that would help economically locally, or just broad educational benefits that you think might be possible, and where could be some connections with different organizations here from the kind of thing that she's sharing with you. So, let me... take the cover off of it here.
Hello, everyone. I want to mention something really quick, because Dawn mentioned that I was involved in some video production stuff, and one of those productions was called Strange Days on Planet Earth, and it was a four-part series. It was actually an eight-part series. The first four parts was part one, and then there was an additional series of four parts for our second series. But part of that was talking about marine debris and plastics in our ocean, and we developed from that production a viral video that's on YouTube. It's called Bag the Bag. You might want to go on to PBS, onto nationalgeographic.org and look for Bag the Bag. It'll be playing on that as well as YouTube. And it's an interesting piece, and it's very viral, and it could be interesting to your work. But there's a lot of stuff going on with cities banning plastic bags. So, good work, everyone. Okay, I'm going to embark on telling you a little bit about my project. It's only been about 8 months that I've came on board with the Monterey Bay Sanctuary Foundation. And we overview, most of you know about the MLPA, how it came about, the act that was passed in 1999, and how we, as a state of California, kind of led the nation in creating a network of marine protected areas, or creating a legislation to create these. The first region that was designated was the Central Coast. We had 29 of them designated in 2007, but it's taken a few years for us to kind of get our ball rolling on education and outreach. And part of the impetus was that most people don't know that we have marine protected areas. Most of the public isn't aware of it, and so we really realized that the need for education and outreach. My work is focused solely on education and outreach. I have a little bit of funding that I'm going to support some enforcement areas, but mostly it's education and outreach for the public. We have, I love hearing about collaborations because my project is all about collaborations. We're working with a number of organizations to create best products. We're not going after just creating products to disseminate. We're actually going out, talking with our educators, finding out what's useful to them, what's going to be effective, and moving forward with products that are going to be widely used versus something that we're going to produce that goes on a shelf. So some of our partners have been, the Department of Fish and Game has been involved, the state parks, big, huge partners, because as you know, a lot of our marine protected areas along the Central Coast are adjacent to our state parks. The sanctuary has been a huge partner, as well as we have a number of organizations that have been partnering with us. The Ocean Conservancy has really been involved, and we have ancillary organizations like Save Our Shores and other NGOs that have been involved in the process as well. I love it. I love the fact that we have both federal and non-government and governmental agencies working together on this project, because this was basically a government project. We saw the need for education and outreach. We collaborated with private funding to create an initiative to move forward, because we knew it wasn't, we weren't going to have the funding to pursue it with just the Department of Fish and Game's efforts. My project goals are to provide education and outreach to the public and to the constituents that use the resources, and to also enhance the overall education of all the organizations that do marine education along the coast. And so it's not just, it's creating a cohesive message for marine protected areas along with all the organizations that communicate with the public on ocean issues. As I mentioned, I came on the project in July of 2008, and we have about 21 months, I think, for this project. It's very, very fast-paced project, which you wouldn't see in the normal government sector. So as a nonprofit, we're really moving things forward because we really realize the need is out there. I'm working solely right now on product development and dissemination, and as well as an evaluation plan for my project. And then we'll have, hopefully, we're putting together at the end of this year, beginning of next, a funding proposal for another year or so. Some of the products that I'm going to talk to you about, I'm going to tell you all about all of the things that we're going to be developing, but we've got some key things that are coming down the slot and that you'll be seeing in the Morro Bay area. First of all, we embarked on a Train the Trainers workshop. We gathered together about 70 ocean educators, and these were from the entire Central Coast. There was representatives from the North Central MLPA region, as well as the South Coast MLPA region. And it was a collaboration between the Sanctuary, Ocean Conservancy, my group. A number of speakers were involved. It was a great two-day program where we had lectures for our docents and volunteers, trainers that were going out to train their groups. We provided lectures from various scientists. We had a scientist panel. We had user group perspectives. It was a two-day, that was at the first day of the event. The second day of the event was a practical where we integrated in MPA messaging and implementation techniques for interpreting, because interpreting MPAs isn't an easy task. It's an offshore resource, which is really hard to talk about. It's not a tangible resource, so people have a hard time identifying what with MPAs. That was our first event, and from that, we realized the need to develop an MPA in this area. We also are designing the practical sessions so that they are templates for other programs. The one we are designing for Año Nuevo is pretty extensive and will need to be augmented for programs that have limited time with guests. The program at Año Nuevo has a walking program out to the elephant seal, so they have an hour and a half with a guest versus a 10-minute program maybe at Natural Bridges or one of the other state parks where you only have somebody for a few minutes. So the programs will be modified for the various docent programs along the Central Coast.
So are you linking
Central Coast Natural History Association docents that are out of the State Museum here, and then also the Friends of the Elephant Seal docents.
Friends of the Elephant Seal, Friends of Santa Cruz State Parks.
Okay.
I'm trying to network and bring in anybody interested. The lecture series, we're trying to create a large enough forum so that way all docent programs can participate, even if there's two or three. And I found that it was a great opportunity to bring docents together under one roof. Because most of these docents volunteer at one site, and they don't have the opportunity to talk with other people at other sites. So this is going to foster some great communication among docents as well as communicating techniques and interpretation and all kinds of things. I think the docent programs are excited, and I am as well.
Rita, you mentioned that you were working with the Natural History Museum docents, but there are a couple areas that are right on the bay that also have regular, probably seasonal, tours and other kinds of nature walks, and they sit right there at the MPA, and one of them is the Small Wilderness Area Preservation Group,
okay.
And they're very active, and they actually did some major restoration and protection of a sensitive coastal dune area. And the other one is Audubon, and I know Henry is with them. They have Sweet Springs Preserve. And they also have many activities, and they sit right there and look at the
MPA. So I'll definitely
pursue. And I doubt
pursue.
That they're connecting those things.
I'll definitely pursue talking with them. Thank you.
I'm wondering also if you do any work with private companies, because there are nature tour companies that take out a lot of people, especially kayaking, on the bay. And so there's just a large volume of people.
We actually did. During the Train the Trainers, we opened it up for not only state park interpreters, but people from NGOs, vendors. So we had a lot of the kayak connection people, diving organizations there, fishing charter organizations. So we had representatives from, and so they basically were given the same content in a much more deeper level than the next group will receive. Any other questions?
Okay. Are you ready for questions now, or do you want to?
Well, I think that related to that, I'd be happy to.
Might help us in sort of calibrating this,
sure,
Rita,
sure.
To know about how far you are in your presentation.
I'm about halfway through.
Okay. So then I suggest that you continue on with the presentation,
okay.
Then maybe we pick up more questions as there's more information on the table.
So far I've told you about the Train the Trainers workshop. Now we have this MPA enrichment program coming up. We also have a Marine Protected Area traveling exhibit. It was installed at the Pacific Grove Natural History Museum on March 28th, and it'll remain there until June 13th. It's a collaborative project between a number of organizations. It was funded by a number of organizations. This postcard I put on your seat describes just a little bit of information about that opening. I have been soliciting a number of our partners and consortium partners along the coast to move the exhibit to the San Luis Obispo area, and I'm happy to report that we'll be installing it not only up at the Hearst Castle, but it will be going in at the Morro Bay Natural History Museum as well. So I'm working really closely with them to help design not only permanent exhibit panels, but also to provide this traveling exhibit to them as well. There's no cost to this exhibit. This is free, and we are hoping to move it around the Central Coast. It's also going in at Seacliff State Beach, as well as, I'm hopeful, Año Nuevo. So it's going to get some exposure, and then we're likely going to put it in some other locations, then storefront locations that are open along Cannery Row. So we're kind of being creative about the opportunities to display the content. There's also efforts for me to put together permanent exhibit panels at some of our visitor locations at state parks and the Discovery Center at Sandstar Tidal, and people can connect to that. They get the idea that a park is somewhat protected. They don't understand the regulations in most places. And anybody that needs to know the regulations is a fisherman should have a brochure or be able to go to the Department of Fish and Game and get the regulations for where they need to go. So we found that it was more appropriate to provide the general public with an overview of content rather than trying to make them conform to all of our acronyms and et cetera. So we have some great panels. They've been installed. They've been under great review right now by children and adults, school groups, et cetera. And I've already started to receive some evaluation from it. And it's amazing. It's really hit home. People are really embracing it. And I was, of course, a little worried at first. You know, this is a controversial issue, and we didn't want to undermine any of the concerns that constituents have regarding marine protected areas. And so we wanted to be really basically tell the public these are out there. They're ready for you to enjoy. Go and enjoy them. And so it was basically here they are. Enjoy them, and we didn't get into the process, and we just wanted to make them aware of that these MPAs exist. Another thing that we're working on is creating a portal website. There's a lot of great information on the website, but it's all over the place, and I noticed over in just the 6 or 8 months that I've been on this project how much more information has come onto the internet on MPAs. And so we're trying to create kind of a portal, a place that shows the best of, so educators can get their resources quicker, because we're finding that most people are having to dig to find content. And so we're trying to lift the content to a level that's accessible to everyone. Especially our marine educators that are out there talking to the public. We're working with our consortium partners to update websites. As you know, we designated these in 2007, it's 2009, and some of the websites, state parks, don't even have indication that they have a reserve there. So we're working with a lot of our partners to update websites and create linkages to a lot of the great programs that are out there. Another product we're working on, and I'm going to share a little bit of it with you tonight, is film products and video products. I don't know if any of you have seen the Thank You Oceans campaign. It was a beautifully put together PSA that unfortunately didn't get a whole lot of broadcast. And so we're working with the Resources Agency in the hopes to augment that Thank You Oceans campaign and add a MPA message to the end of it. And then I have some funding to broadcast, do a pilot broadcast. So I'm hoping to get this moving relatively quickly forward so I can get that out to the public, hopefully this summer, fall. Another element of our video production stuff is a larger video piece that will be used in my video. Sounds got like I lost my audio. Is a larger video piece that will be used for kind of an educational purposes, for training, et cetera. It will be a 7 to 9 minute piece. And from that piece, we're developing a smaller piece that will be able to play in the visitor centers, et cetera. Some of our partners are interested in providing vignettes, short informational 30 to 60 second pieces for internet distribution, media, internet, YouTube, that kind of thing. And so we're hoping to provide short clips, vignettes, and independent little clips that will also be generated from this content. I'm all about sharing everything that I am doing. So I'm about everything that all original content that's produced from the video, I'm going to make available to our partners if they want to recut it into something or if they want to augment it in some way. I'm providing print material content to our partners, trying to make their world a little easier to get information together and providing the elements to put print materials together or whatever it needs to be done for their organization. So I'm all about sharing this content. I want to show you what we did for the Pacific Grove opening of the exhibit. I pushed forward the production of one of the elements of the video.
we realize that people have a really difficult time understanding that the MPAs protect not only animals but habitat as well. And so we thought by providing an animation, we'd be able to show people.
Very good. This is just a preview. Sorry, some technical issues. Are we good?
It's not the screen size.
Okay, now we got it.
Here we go.
Now. Now it won't
work.
Okay. Sorry, folks. We'll get there. Drag it back. Start it. It's not.
Yeah, I'm not getting.
There's something going on here.
Oh, you know why?
This isn't my computer. It's my disclaimer.
How about this?
We
get
all
hung
together. That's okay. We don't mind at home. It adds drama.
Do you have your speaker on?
I don't hear it either. Well, you get to see it. Basically, it's a fly down into California. We move into a marine protected area. It's Point Lobos for this shot. It'll be Point Bouchon for the San Luis Obispo area. There's a beautiful narration that goes with it. But we'll link live footage in with the Point Bouchon as well.
We could sing.
I don't know. It's not even like... Yeah, this, I don't know if this is worth us looking at, considering. Yeah. Is it okay? This is high definition, so once it plays on a high definition screen, you'll get the... Well up from the canyon's great depths. Support the entire food chain, from the small and the strange... to the large and the powerful, both below and above the waves. It's no small wonder that Point Lobos has earned the title of the crown jewel of the California park system. So we're doing a similar one for Point Bouchon. The video component is pretty much done. We have some tweaking to do, but we're going to be adding in the live footage over the next little bit. And this will be ready for distribution at the when the exhibit moves to the San Luis Obispo area. So that'll be playing on the video there. Okay, bear with me as we bring back my PowerPoint. Back up. We've got to talk about signage. Can you go back? Okay. One of the big elements of our project is creating signage for the Central Coast for MPAs. There's a number of programs that have already embarked on signage, both regulatory, interpretive signage. But we are trying to coordinate our efforts a bit, and with not only the Department of Fish and Game, but I know the sanctuary has been involved with some signage that's going in on the Monterey Peninsula. And so I've been working with a number of agencies to create a plan for sign implementation. I know down here in San Luis Obispo, we've had some, I guess I could term it, almost sign graffiti or sign litter. A lot of the local residents are concerned that more signs are going to go into locations that are interpreting the same thing. And so I'm really diligently working with the other agencies that are updating signs or pursuing putting in signs so we can create a collaborative sign for multi-points in various locations, whether you need a boundary sign, regulatory sign, an interpretive sign, that kind of thing. And it's still a little ways off, but I'm hopeful we'll get our handle around this. And once I sit down with the other agencies, we have a firm plan we can start implementing. But I want you to know that it is coming down the line. Finally, some other things that we're working on are print materials. And I'll tell you, I have with me one copy, and the only copy, of the Department of Fish and Game's new brochure. So you're welcome to look at it. It's a pretty extensive brochure. It's modeled after the Channel Islands brochure. And right now, this isn't a perfectly printed copy, but I'll show you. It has a front and a back. There's the open, and it opens up to this unbelievable page of maps for all the locations. So it's really extensive. It has all the regulations on it. There are some revisions that need to happen with it, but we're hopeful that we're going to be able to support their efforts to do a print run and distribute this to the organizations that need it. This Department of Fish and Game brochure is one of the main brochures for regulations and enforcement, but we need to put together some education and outreach materials as well. And so we're going to be working with the department and other agencies to create materials, you know, similar but not as extensive as this, for not only the Monterey area but also the San Luis Obispo area. We also are seeking to enhance efforts for enforcement by providing some camera remote sensing in various locations to help enforcement where it's really difficult for enforcement agents to get out there. We also are working on putting out a RFP to our consortium partners, and that's to fund programs, to develop programs associated with MPA education and outreach. And this could be the development of a educational program with an academic program through schools. It could be augmentation of materials. It could be funding of a seasonal support staff to help with docent training related to MPAs. I mean, there's a variety, and so we're really excited to provide some funding to our partners to help them develop more extensive programs individually. We're also working on a speakers bureau, and we've already started to assemble our list. What we're going to do is potentially just put together a list of all the experts and what their qualifications are and what they can speak on, and provide that to organizations wanting to have someone come and talk on MPAs. Now, obviously, these would be speakers willing to come out and speak to various groups. And I think this is a great resource. This is something that the department, also, the Department of Fish and Game has spoken about, you know, finding a need to provide information to the public in public setting and forums, that kind of thing. And so having a speakers bureau available to groups could be really valuable in spreading the word about MPAs. The other thing, finally, I want to mention that it's mostly all I'm working on is informal education, but I see the need with our formal educators to provide some MPA activities, academic activities. And so I've begun to talk with some academics about putting together activities, some modules on MPA-related activities. And so we're exploring that as a possibility as well, an extension of what we're doing. And this is an extension of what I believe is important, kind of getting, because we have got school groups coming out to state parks, et cetera. It would be great to connect them with activities in the classroom. So that is mostly... mostly everything that I'm involved with as far as product development and dissemination. Does anybody have questions about... Certainly, Carolyn.
As you went through your presentation, I'm
very appreciative of the really beautiful job that you're doing. It's very well... organized, and it's going to be very effective. But I do have maybe a concern or two. One of the most important elements that this group has recognized in our collaborative studies and in the formation of our MIG is that there be balanced representation from all the stakeholders. And I'm wondering, in developing your collaborative network, if you have included representatives from, say, the fishing industry, and they do develop educational materials, and they are pretty much centered on the Central Coast, but they go up into... I know a number of the members are residents up in the Elkhorn Slough area, up in Monterey, and they do develop educational materials.
Oh, that's great.
And I would be very happy to help you connect with that group
if
you'd like to. And then another point that I was wondering, does the concept of adaptive management enter into your... educational presentations?
Yes, we have been talking about and actually are featuring the cooperative efforts that Dean has been involved in, as well as materials in the exhibit. We talk about the science of MPAs and adaptive management, the fact that this will be a evolving process, that this is we're embarking on for the first time actually looking at managing these marine areas based on science and how it could change over time, and adapting our plan later on may happen. And so that's definitely been part of our materials.
Is that part of the material that you're presenting to the public?
Yes.
This is an evolving, changeable
That's right.
concept. Thank you very much,
Rita.
I think you're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you.
I was just going to offer a strong endorsement suggestion that one of the main aspects in reaching to the people, outreaching to the ones you're trying to educate to what an MPA is, I think the strongest way to do that, you're dealing essentially with terrestrial folks, you know, standing on the shoreline.
Yes.
The best way to do that is to really enhance the mapping and to show the linkage from the land side to the ocean side, mm-hmm. so that they understand where these boundaries are and how they interact and where they are on their personal map as well. So I would just strongly endorse using maps as the primary focus to get things started and then go strongly from there.
Yes, and you know, as a matter of fact, we decided to move away from regulatory maps for the public because they're a little overwhelming, and we actually designed much more user-friendly maps for our exhibit, which will actually be going into the print materials, et cetera. And we're going to be developing pocket maps, I'm going to call them, and that is highlighted areas. So in other words, we're going to have one. We have one for the Monterey Peninsula. We'll also do one for the Morro Bay region. So when the maps get displayed here, people can actually have something referenced really close up for their region.
Good. And if I could just follow on that, I have to confess a certain addiction to Google Maps.
It's
amazing how you can type place names in.
Yes, and we're linking
with
that
phone,
actually.
I think that'd be really...
We're hoping to work with them to put the animation on there.
it's a dependency.
In that regard, Rita, I know one of the things that the city of Morro Bay and Avila Beach and others are working on is trying to figure out, you know, how to do more ecotourism. What information do you have about how, the degree to which this information might assist with or support ecotourism marketing of an area? Is there any evidence that areas like this have that benefit? And if so, what has been learned elsewhere about how best to capitalize on that?
Well, I don't know of any evidence offhand, but I can say just from the materials that we're producing, we're making people aware, we're kind of dispelling the misconception that these places are restricted and you can't go there. So we're trying to feature user groups, people that actually would be utilizing them, fishermen, divers, kayakers. And so in my exhibit materials, as well as a lot of our video production materials, we're going to be featuring people utilizing these resources. And so I can see an easy connection for someone to say, gosh, you know, I've always wanted to be a diver. What a great opportunity. I'm going to be a diver and go dive that new MPA. You never know what the extension might be. I haven't done any surveys to know, so I wouldn't be able to or qualified to be able to answer that. But I can say that I would imagine it's going to drive some interest to explore in ways that they might not have otherwise, via kayaks and things like that, which are definitely vehicles for ecotourism and driving economics along our coast. So you never know. You never know what the impact could be on someone that's looking over the materials. I'm hopeful that will generate some interest and people will go in, out and explore them.
Okay. So there are questions, suggestions, or ideas?
Janice had a question.
Yeah, I'd just like to follow up on what Carolyn said about the fishing industry and how that was a very important part of the formation of these, and that hopefully the educational message will be that while these were formed to protect and rebuild stuff,
Fish and Game should cease the MPA project unless they had a commitment budgetary-wise to fund the monitoring follow-up. If I could go back to when the MPA process started, Mike Christman, who's the Resources Secretary, came here to Morro Bay. There were a number of fishermen here in Morro Bay, commercial and recreational, who challenged him as to whether or not these MPAs are beneficial or helpful to any marine species. And he promised at that time, Mike Christman did, that the monitoring of the MPAs, the type of stuff and modeling that Dean is working on, was absolutely an essential part of the MPAs. Now it turns out, Sankey Mastrup, who's the Deputy Director of Fish and Game, says that their bare-bones monitoring cost statewide for this process is going to be at least $9 million a year. He said that if they wanted to do a job that provided some scientific value that the rest of the world could look at to determine whether they should use MPAs, that it's probably going to cost $25 or $30 million a year. RLFF, who has been funding the process so far, has said they are not going to be funding the monitoring. The legislature has said they are not going to provide the money to do the monitoring. So there is an issue right now about where the money is coming, given our budgetary constraints, to do the scientific follow-up to determine if these MPAs are actually beneficial. So you ought to know this funding issue in California is really hurting all kinds of segments of the state, including Fish and Game and the monitoring process. Maybe Dean has more information on this.
You mean on where the money's coming
from? Yeah.
I'm looking for it.
I see it as the big problem for the next years. I mean, it's one thing to do the little monitoring in the Central Coast. Wait till it's statewide. It's a lot more money. And they take the Central Coast. You tell me how many of the MPAs are actually being monitored. In our area, it's only Point Bouchon, right?
No, in our area, this is on, it's Piedras Blancas and Point Bouchon.
What's being done at Piedras Blancas?
This last year we did both the commercial trap and the recreational hook and line surveys.
You did grid like you did at Point Bouchon?
Yes.
Oh, good.
So we augmented that. And then Pete Raimondi from UC Santa Cruz is doing intertidal monitoring, I think, in most of the 29. They do a one-time sort of thing. And same with Mark Carr, who's doing dive surveys. They hit most of the MPAs, but their sampling is, more narrow in its temporal coverage. But they spatially are trying to hit almost all of them. And I don't know the details of the socioeconomic and what they're doing, actually. And then the other monitoring team is the deeper water submersible monitoring. And I think that's just in the Monterey area. You might even know. It's just in the Monterey area. So it's not ideal coverage, but that program right there was between $2 and $3 million, I would say, at least a year to do it. So
there's also a new baseline monitoring survey that just came out from Fish and Game that has, unfortunately, I don't know how you find this on the internet. I could send it to Don, and Don can email it to the members, and I'd be happy to send this report around. It gives you some idea of where the baseline monitoring survey results are, and also Dean is in that as well.
But the issue that you're raising about funding is a critical one. As you know, there's a major initiative going on here for collaborative fisheries research to help in determining how to do regional fisheries management. And we were, frankly, fairly well lined up with the Ocean Protection Council and others for funding of that until the state budget crisis happened. The bond funding got frozen, and the OPC's source of money to be supporting these kinds of activities, including the ongoing monitoring of the MPAs, all got locked up. So that's prompted all of the projects, ours included, to be scrambling for, okay, what to do in the interim, how to sustain these data sets, which we've all learned and which Dean will highlight in a few moments, all require, years of consistent data collection to see trends and patterns in order to evaluate the tough questions that you and many people have about, how it's...
The monitoring is not funded, then the adaptive management part of the... It doesn't? No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it's not possible. You can't adaptively manage unless you monitor.
Oh, okay. Okay, so there we are.
PJ?
Just back on the sort of idea of distribution of information, a couple of the resources that I found very helpful are the Chambers of Commerce tend to have a really good distribution to visitors. Also, we have various kiosks, visitor kiosks through Friends of the Hearst Castle that they have a monitor at the airport, at Visitor Center, and people can actually look at maps and see where things are. So that's just a couple of... Friends of Hearst Castle.
Okay.
They have three different kiosks throughout San Luis Obispo County.
There's also the County Visitors and Conference Bureau. Mm-hmm. There's the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, both of whom have visitor guides.
Right.
And this is a feature that some people would find attractive for visiting the area. And, you probably want to have some, just like there's a page about Hearst Castle and there's a page about whatever, there might be some portion of attention given to these resources and people's interest in learning about them is one of the reasons for coming.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Yeah, Monica.
Monica.
Yeah, I wanted to get back maybe one more point about the monitoring and the way in which science and research are being represented in the materials you're developing. And I'm hoping that the collaborative research effort is going to be incorporated in that and that visually... we see the combination of both science and research and education being applied in the sense of high tech, but that we also see the local community members who are part of the fishing fleets who also possess a very deep knowledge of the environment. And I think representing the values of coastal communities, the richness of that history, and kind of the pride that folks have in their fishing fleets. I know in Morro Bay, and I'm sure it's true in Monterey, the tourism has been affected by the decline of and presence of the fishing fleets. And so I think it would be very helpful to show that fishermen are part of the solution. Fishermen have a lot to contribute to that, and that the scientific community is really working in partnership to maximize what we all know as human beings. We live in this environment, and so we have different perspectives and different experiences. So I'm hoping that will come across. I think it's also important to show it's a very unique combination of local knowledge and high-tech application of the best of what we know. So I'll look forward to seeing that.
Well, I'll let you know really quickly that, in fact, we featured some of the work that Dean and Rick are doing. We went out and filmed the cooperative fishing effort, went out in both trips down here as well as in Monterey, and have footage from that, which we included in the exhibit. And so we have features of those groups of fishermen standing around looking at the giant fish laying out on the board to get measured, and we talk about that. We talk a lot about monitoring above and below and how important that is, and the cooperative effort of the public. Mm-hmm. As well as we have on our table ways to get involved. And we have actually a flyer there asking for participants to join that cooperative fishing effort. So we are engaging that, definitely.
Okay, well, we have another key topic to cover this evening. So is there any other pressing item? I know that Rita is looking for good underwater footage of the Point Bouchon sort of area. So if you know of sources for that, or you'd like to offer something along those lines, let her know. Really, thank you for coming, Rita. And when do you think we'll get a product for Point Bouchon that people can look at here?
Well, we're working to potentially get the exhibit here in the fall. So I'm certain it's going to be, the animation will be ready for that exhibit then. It'll also go into our video, which I'm hoping to be wrapped by the end of the year on that. So probably closer to fall, end of the year, before you see the standalone animation for Point Bouchon. It'll be ready earlier, but it won't be public knowledge. I'd be happy to share that, though, when it's done. I'll share that with Don and send that on to him so you guys can all look at it as well.
Okay. Well, thanks for making the trip down from Monterey.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate
for having
you.
Me. Very
okay.
much.
Good. Great. So our second key item for tonight is on the collaborative fisheries research results. And our citizen scientists who are in the audience here and went out on a trip at MPAs, they're actually becoming a tool to be increasingly understanding how we can better manage, in particular at a regional level, the fisheries resources by having this ability to compare at a local level fished and unfished areas. So there's a lot of interest in this. Since we are the first area for these MPAs to be coming into play, we're sort of the focal point of how to do this. So organizations from all over are taking a look, and scientists from all over, we were just at a meeting yesterday, but we're expressing interest. People, the top scientists from NOAA, are interested in, okay, what are we learning? How can we use this? And how could this be used to support good stewardship at a regional level, which would be of value to our fishermen and our fishing communities and to the fish species themselves. So there's a real important linkage here. Dean and the scientist crew have been looking at, okay, how to leverage that opportunity and to help it be successful. So Dean, please share your results.
Great.
And we'll look at some point to hear a few comments
yes.
from our citizen scientists, fishing folks here about their experience in going out on the boats and actually doing this work and what it was like, you know, personally to do that. So please kind of be prepared back there. We're going to
Now you can't leave.
Call on you.
There are
going
to be four
good
people.
He's very good as a professor at calling out and figuring out when to call on students.
Right. So. As soon as I see him going to sleep, I'm going to ask him a question.
There you go.
Anyway, before I formally begin, I want to recognize Leslie Longebach, who is putting me up to giving this talk. She, you know, this was her presentation, but she said, no, you do it. Anyway, Leslie has just done an incredible job coordinating and working with the hundreds of volunteer anglers. And so she made a mistake early on giving out her personal cell phone in a newspaper article. But she learned that, you know, perhaps the lab number is a better one or maybe an email address. But anyway, she's done a terrific job of orchestrating and organizing many of the efforts that I'm going to be talking about over the next few minutes. So, with that, if we could turn the lights down a little bit, I don't have a laser pointer, so I'm going to be moving back and forth. I've got a mobile microphone, which will allow me to do that. We're going to be discussing a couple of programs, both a commercial TRAP collaborative protocol and then also our recreational angler CPFV protocol, which is commercial passenger fishing vessel protocol. And this is a joint effort that includes Cal Poly and the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance, SLOSEA. This is one of their six key strategies that they're focusing on, fisheries, and I'll talk about that in a moment. The collaborative work is a component of a larger strategy that really spans policy through science and management and community. And we're collaborating with Rick Starr at the Moss Landing Marine Labs, and he's a Sea Grant advisor. So it's a larger program than just our community, but I'd like to think, and I do know, that a lot of it grew out of the early work that started with this group in 2002 and 2003 with our collaborative fisheries research that was instrumental in, I think, leading to this effort that we're seeing now. So we've formally developed a group called the California Collaborative Fisheries Research Program. We have a logo and we have t-shirts. You can look at the volunteer anglers. They actually have t-shirts and hats. And the goal here is pretty simple in concept, and it's fairly, you know, it takes a lot of work to implement it. But the goal is simple, and that is to develop a statewide program for stock assessment and MPA monitoring, utilizing fishermen's knowledge and expertise in collaboration with the scientists and fishery science expertise. So that's our broad goal for the monitoring part of this program. And the work that we've done so far really extends from Point Bouchon to Point Reyes. And we're currently monitoring MPAs throughout that region. Some encouraging news is that staff at Fish and Game have taken both our TRAP protocol and our hook and line protocol, and they're doing some monitoring in the Monterey area in another marine reserve. So that's the actual staff from Fish and Game that are using that. We are working with folks at UCSB at the Bren School in developing and translating these protocols to the area south. We have made connections and we have interest from researchers at the Bodega Marine Lab with UC Davis. That community would like to implement these protocols, so we're making those connections. And also the Humboldt area, the Port of Eureka, that fishing community. Rick Starr and I have both been up to that community to talk to them about our protocols, and they actually want to be a little preemptive and begin the monitoring, but unfortunately that just got cut off midstream for obvious reasons. So But we're still going to do some sampling this year. We don't know the extent to which we'll be covering in time and space, but we know that we will have money to do some sampling to keep it going. This is a huge effort, as I mentioned at the outset. We've worked with commercial fishermen and trapping folks both in the Monterey area and northward, and then people that you're familiar with like Roger Cullen and Tom Hafer here locally. We've worked with both of the, for the hook and line, of course, we've worked with the companies locally, Patriot Sports Fishing and Verges. And you notice, I'm sure, many of the names there and all sorts of deckhands with both the commercial and recreational folks. And then, naturally, the hundreds of volunteers that we've had on the boats out fishing as part of the hook and line survey. So today we're going to talk about the results from the collaborative fisheries research, the ways that the data are being used for management, or we hope that they'll be used for management, and we'll summarize some of the things that we've done well and what we've learned, and maybe talk about some recommendations. I will say at the outset, and I'm sure the whole place is going to rush as soon as I say this, I'm not going to tell you one thing about whether or not MPAs are effective. Okay, this is not the data at this point. We've got 2 years of data for the hook and line and 1 year of data for the commercial trap. That tells you nothing in terms of how these MPAs are functioning. So don't look for that. You won't find it. This is strictly going to be descriptive in terms of we're just going to be describing. We're setting up the baseline. We're going to be describing what species are there, how big they are, and we'll have some measure of what the density of species are. And then we're going to be looking for how that changes over time. And not to be discouraging, but the fishery scientists, this is Steve Ralston and Alec McCall that we spent the afternoon with yesterday in Monterey, reviewing our protocols and our data, said it takes, they think, 10 years to see an effect. And that, especially with the fish, and that is because these fish have very long generation times. It takes a long time for them to become sexually mature and reproduce, and so you can't look for an effect on a time scale that's shorter than their lifespan, essentially, or a good portion of their lifespan. And so it takes a while for the system to respond. So that's either encouraging or discouraging. That's the way it is. It's biology. It's ecology. It's what we have to deal with. Okay. So we have a series, like I said, we've really just started the baseline surveys. We're generating a baseline of comparisons between the MPAs, the marine protected areas, the underwater parks, if you will, and reference sites. These are areas of similar habitat that are reasonably co-located with the marine protected areas. And we're tracking simultaneously, same time, same methodology, how things are changing within those two areas. So we developed a series of protocols. They're scientifically sound. They've been vetted with fishery scientists. And we're doing that by engaging the fishermen knowledge. So the protocols are absolutely, they've been modified and updated based on fishermen input. The gear we used, the way it's designed, it's been designed by fishermen, built by fishermen, and so we've really utilized what they have to say about how to fish, but we've done it in a way that confines what they would do when they're fishing so that it produces a scientific study that stock assessment folks and people at Fish and Game can use to evaluate the effectiveness of these areas and do stock assessments. So it combines both of those things. So we've created a sampling design not just for MPAs, but also in the long run to provide information for stock assessments. So we think we're trying to get two birds with one stone. And that's not what I meant to do. Okay, so this is just a how the data are going to be used for MPA monitoring. And this is a graph that shows on the y-axis, which is the one that goes up, some sort of metric. And that metric can be mean length or catch per unit effort. That is, how many fish are you catching per unit of time? And it's looking at it as a function of time on the x-axis, which is the axis going horizontally. And so the idea is that when you implement an MPA, you've collected a baseline that models that are being developed around using MPAs to set catch levels, using a different set of tools and methodologies. And the data that we're collecting, if those get developed and they're robust, which takes a long time to happen as well because the science has to be reviewed, the fishery scientists have to agree that it works, but these data would be used for those models as well. So we're getting the data. We're hoping, you know, in retrospect, 10 years from now, they're going to say, oh, my gosh, we're glad we have the data to run all of the models that have been developed. So that's the two main goals for this. So here are the areas, the trapping project. I'm going to stand up just because I think it might help. I don't have a... Hello? Can you hear that? Hello? Okay, well, you'll tell me if you can't hear it. Woo! Everyone awake? Holy moly. That's great. Gosh, okay, there we go. Are we good now? All right, because if this starts to screech, I'm not going to use it. So the trapping project is in four MPAs, Año Nuevo, Point Lobos, Piedras Blancas, and Cambria. And those were chosen for reasons of representation of different kinds of habitats, but also they were chosen... for instance, Cambria was chosen because we spoke with fishermen and Piedras in this area about what MPAs would be good to monitor. Which ones do you think would be good to monitor? And so there was input in which ones we were monitoring from the fishing community. And then the hook and line project is slightly different. That's not important. Año Nuevo and Point Lobos are the same, but then Piedras Blancas and... just Point Bouchon. So the big difference is the Cambria for the commercial trap, because it's an area that they go to and have gone to historically quite a bit, and it became an MPA. So it was an area that we wanted to look into. So very briefly, the sampling protocols, Moss Landing does the north, Cal Poly does the south. I've talked about our additional collaborators. We sampled in 2007 in August, September, in October, and then in 2008, July, August, and September, 4 days each month in each MPA and reference site. So there was 2 days in the MPA and 2 days in the corresponding reference site for each of these particular areas. Yes.
What species are being targeted in the trapping study?
I'll show you all the ones we caught, but it's a, you know, the cabazon. And the nearshore, all nearshore. Yeah, this is all in the MPA, so all nearshore. And I'll show you the collection of species that were caught in the traps. So we have the recreational hook and line. This just duplicates what I've already said. I just want to emphasize again, we had a series of planning workshops where we worked with both the fishery scientists and also the commercial and recreational fishermen, folks from NGOs, and then also the academic scientists. And this is just a representative. So this is Point Lobos. We had these sorts of maps for Point Bouchon and for Cambria as well. But what we did is we had fishermen say, using these maps, where are the good areas to fish based on your knowledge and also these maps? And where are the areas that are not so good? And they went to maps and they circled these areas. And then we took those areas and we made cells that had both good fishing, and the yellow here denote areas that were very good, and the green were areas that were moderately good. And this is important for the statistics and the processing of the data afterwards, knowing where the good habitat is and where the bad habitat, and designing the best sampling scheme. So we use their knowledge to what's called stratify the area according to good and bad habitat. And then we further divided an area that they said, okay, this is good habitat. We divided it up into half kilometer by half kilometer, quarter mile by quarter mile cells. And each of these cells then is selected at random for a particular day. And so we might go to three or four cells in a given day, and that's done randomly. So we have an equal opportunity of going to each of these. That's an important scientific consideration. So they'll go to this cell, and that cell in a given day, and the captain is told that, and then they go there. And then once they're there, they get to fish how they fish within that area. So they get to use their knowledge and their expertise to catch the fish that are there within that spot. Okay, so that was very important to them to be able to use their skill to catch the fish. But it's constrained, obviously, right? They can't go anywhere. And that still upsets them. Look at the colors. Standardized the bait, 1 pint of squid per trap. And so all of these traps were built specifically for this project, and they've been distributed up and down the coast. And so everyone's using the same trap, same baiting, same soak times. All of those issues are standardized, as I've said. So there's a trap with fish. And this gives you an idea, just a summary of the different areas, the number of days, vessels, traps fished, so on and so forth. I'll speak about the total. So we spent, I'm going to knock this down, 44 days on the water for this project. We used 5 different vessels. We fished over almost 2,100 traps. I say we loosely, right? They fished them. And we there's some other data here. Number of fishes caught, almost 2,500 fish. Number of invertebrates caught, 2,600 different invertebrates. And so you can see it's and you think about this data set over time, it becomes a relatively robust data set. So here are some of the crab species, the Dungeness crab and red rock crab, and then things that we don't eat as much, things like Pugetia, which is the northern kelp crab, or the sharp-nosed crab, were very common in the traps. All sorts of sea stars, bat stars, and leather stars, and the sunflower star, Helianthoides, that big, beautiful, this one here, right? That one is very common in the traps. What's that? No, okay. You can interrupt me, but if you interrupt me, it's your own peril, because you're going to make me do this longer, and then you're going to have to stay. So let me go unless it's really urgent. So what this shows, though, those are the pretty pictures. This actually shows some data. And what this shows is, this is for Año Nuevo. And this is, the BL is Piedras Blancas. This is Point Lobos and Cambria. And this shows, these are pie charts that show the collection of invertebrates. The different colors are the different species. The black is the bat star. The brown is the red rock crab. The brown rock crab. The red is the red rock crab. The green is the sharp-nosed crab. And the yellow is the sunflower star. And then a bunch of others, which is just white. What you should take from this is not that each of those colors, knowing what species are each of those colors, but the invertebrates, you could see across this area, are fairly similar. Those pie charts look relatively similar. It's the same suite of species and in somewhat similar proportions, although somewhat different. We're not tagging any of these, but something that came out of the meeting yesterday, which was very interesting, I thought, was we can do some analysis, and this is a great master's thesis, I think, to try to see if there are certain invertebrate communities that are associated with different fish communities to get at the ecology of the area, which is very important to understand. And I learned it's even more important than just knowing the ecology. There are models for stock assessments that are more sophisticated than they use now. They rely on some of the interactions between species and knowing what's happening in an MPA relative to an area outside of an MPA. And the fishery scientists say they're very data heavy. You need to have a lot of information to run these models, and it's this kind of ecological interactions that they need to know. So it can be used for those practical purposes as well. It's just not understanding the basic ecology of the area. So although we're not tagging any of them, we do have all kinds of information about CPUE, that is how many we catch per unit time and so on and so forth. So here are the fish communities, and Henry, you asked about this, and I'll go ahead and identify. I know you got to squint. That's why I'm up, because I knew this was going to be an issue. This is the gopher rockfish, and you can see it's a large proportion in each of these areas. Again, this is Año Nuevo, Piedras Blancas, Point Lobos, and Cambria. So you can see our area in Cambria has a huge amount of gophers. And then it's kind of hard to see these colors, but this is the black and yellow rockfish, Cabazon, and the kelp greenling, and then a series of others, which is multiple species that showed up in much lower percentages. And so what the take-home from this graph is, again, it's really a similar suite of species, although we can definitely see just from the color some distinct differences in the composition or the abundance of those different communities.
And Dean, I might just interject here.
Please.
In terms of, you know, why do commercial trap? Why work with a commercial fisherman? Why use this sort of tackle? And why look at these species? And one of the main issues, because you can't easily get your tackle down into those areas without getting hung up and having other problems. I'm seeing some of you laughing there that you probably had enough hang-ups on the rocks already from your trip. So that's why we're doing commercial trap, not only to involve the commercial fishermen, but because there's really a strategic need both for the economy and for the science of this to use this technique.
And I would say that, yeah, for species like Cabazon, that's absolutely true. And the gophers, which we got in fairly high abundance in the traps, the anglers will say, well, we got a lot of gophers with the hook and line as well. So there is some overlap as well, and that's interesting for comparison reasons too. But there are certainly some species like the kelp greenling, and then also the Cabazon, which we get a lot less with the hook and line survey, definitely. So this is showing mean lengths. Again, I'm sure these are too small to see, but this on the y-axis is mean total length in centimeters, and then these are different species. And the two bars are MPA here in white and reference site in gray. And so this is the beginning of the baseline to show you what are the sizes of the fish in MPAs and reference sites. And so that's what you're comparing here. This is for Año Nuevo and Point Lobos. And you'll see already, right, this is just the first year, that there are differences between these sites at the start. And so it would be false to attribute that to any MPA effect, because there hasn't been an MPA effect. There's just a habitat difference or some other difference that is accounting for these size differences. Many of them are very similar, which is what we would expect. Some are a little bit different, and we have to see how that changes over time, right? And that's what's important. How do they track over time? This is showing Piedras Blancas for the same kinds of data. Again, mean total length. And then the different colors, MPA in white or blue here in reference site is in magenta, and then gray. So same kind of situation. Most of them are the same size, which is what we would expect for the first year of sampling. And this is showing similar kind of graph where there's a variable on the y-axis, the catch per hour. So this is per trap per hour. How many fish are in that trap per hour on the y-axis? And this ranges here from 0 to 2. So if a bar is this high, that means 2 fish per hour in that trap, just to give you an idea. And that's the general term for that is CPUE, catch per unit effort. And you'll see in the angler data, the catch per unit effort is not... it's catch per angler per hour, not per trap per hour. Okay, so we can normalize it to a person or a trap or a boat or whatever we want to. but it's a unit, a measure of effort. And you can see that, again, MPA is in the blue and reference is in the red. There are some pretty large differences between the reference site and an MPA that clearly are not because of the MPA. In fact, sometimes you'll see, like, so for here, the MPA at Point Lobos has a lot more gophers than the reference site does. And we can actually explain that, and there may be an MPA effect there, because Point Lobos, a good portion of that reserve, has been there for 30 years. All right, and so that may be, but it hasn't been monitored for 30 years in this way. So we can't definitively say that. We've gone in after the fact. We've taken a snapshot. It's kind of circumstantial evidence. I don't know, that might be the wrong word from a lawyer. But anyway, it's not definitive proof, if for lack of a better word. Proof is one that I don't like at all, but it's not very strong evidence because we haven't tracked it over time. But we have a way to explain it, at least. And you'll see, though, that sometimes, look, for black and yellow, it's actually the other way. Right? And so this is another important point about MPAs. The response of a particular species isn't necessarily going to be bigger, more dense, all of those things that you might associate with an area that you're not fishing, because there's dynamics that happen and ecological interactions that may shift things in the exact opposite way if you get a large predatory fish that then starts eating a different suite of species at greater rates, their values may go down. And so that simple prediction that everything's going to get bigger and there are going to be more of them may not hold true for some species. So, but certainly there is an effect of vessel and location that's demonstrated here. And
Just one observation. You know, while clearly it might take many years to get data to determine whether or not MPAs are effective or not, I think this data, and I know we haven't talked about this, so correct me if you think I'm jumping too far, which is always your good role in pulling me back from the brink of interpretation here. But some of the issues that came up is that while the MPAs were taking away all of the best places to fish, or that was really going to be a major impact. And I think, you know, while it varies somewhat from species to species, but you look at the mean lengths, you look at the catch per unit effort across the different species, and it's not definitively clear that the MPAs have taken the very best of places to fish compared to the reference sites that you've looked at. Now, how that's going to play out over time and whether the other effects and the questions that people have asked is, well, are people then going to so heavily fish the remaining available sites that they're really going to diminish the productivity of those sites dramatically? That is another question. But I think this is providing some information about some basic issues that people were raising is, have you taken all the best spots and we've really got just junk left? Well, I think this is sort of saying, no, you know, there's some reasonable comparability here.
Yeah, I think it depends on the fisherman, though. It depends on the fisherman and the species.
All your reference areas are right next. You didn't pick reference areas that were 20 miles away. You picked them right next to each other.
As close as we could with the
right,
same habitat.
Right, so you really did pick them pretty close to in the same area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And just a note on the best location, part of that, the best fishing areas was the closest fishing areas. It wasn't all dependent on the stock, but some of it, the convenience and the closeness.
Absolutely. And I was going to say that. It depends on where you go, mm-hmm. right? And so for some people, there may be other areas you could go, but it's harder to get there and so on and so forth. So strictly from an amount of fish, size of fish, from the data, I think your interpretation is correct, but there's a whole social element of where do I go, where is it easiest for me to get to, how do I burn the least amount of fuel, so on and so forth, that gets laid into this that may make it suboptimal for them.
Now, my only point was to say these data are providing some insights that we can learn from.
I didn't have to pull you back. So this just adds another, again, this is Catch for Trap Hour. And what this shows is the different areas. You can see there's Año Nuevo here on the bottom. Has a much lower, they don't trap there. And there's a reason they don't trap there. And it's probably because they don't catch a lot of fish there. And then you can look at, this is Piedras Blancas here, this highest point. And so you can compare the different areas and also over time. So here this is July, August, September, October, November. We had one really late trip, and the general trend, as you'll see, is that actually from late summer into late fall, everything seems to fall off. And, of course, you don't have to tell a fisherman that. They probably know that already. But we see this trend over time that as the season goes on and as it gets closer to winter, fishing isn't as good. And the data show that. Not surprisingly. If you're asking strictly from a scientific perspective, I don't think we don't have the physical data to make those sort of correlations yet. A fisherman would probably tell you exactly why they think it's going on. I'm sure it's got to be a change in, I mean, I know things that are changing. Swell is changing throughout this time. Winds are changing. And all of those things, when you talk to a fisherman, are very important in their catch. But a hard correlation with data that were collected, we don't have that.
And we want to be sure to get to our hook and line people.
Yeah, I'm going right now. Okay, so here we are. Look at this, hook and line. There you go. So now we're going to talk about the hook and line. So this is, a very intense effort. It involves coordinating a lot of volunteers, hundreds of people. And this shows a little bit the way we distributed anglers on the boat. The bow has people with lingcod bars, which are shown here. Shrimp flies with squid bait on the port side. And then the starboard side has shrimp flies and no bait. And so that's how the anglers are distributed on the boat. Tags that get placed in between the dorsal spine, right underneath the dorsal fin, and that's a typical tagged fish, and they also get measured for their lengths, and in certain species, sexed, if you can do that. And then for a number of species that are particularly sensitive to barotrauma, we sink them. So we either use this descending device that clips onto the lip, or a milk crate that's weighted, and you put that over the fish and you get it back down as quick as possible. And the idea is the fish are on board for a very short amount of time, and then they are put back in the water and tagged and put back in the water as soon as possible. So here are some of the folks we work with. You probably recognize Michelle. And here are some more pretty pictures off of Point Bouchon on a beautiful day. And here are some more pictures on a foggy day. And you see our nice caps, of course, right? Those are our logos. Happy anglers. This is just how aggressive a lingcod is. It's going after a hook that's bigger than it is. love it. You got to love someone with heart, right? You know? And we really do, and this is, I'm very proud of this because there is a lot of the outreach and education, and this goes both ways. I think the science team is learning from the anglers and the fishermen, and the learning is certainly reciprocal. We have these workshops in these areas to talk about the data like we're doing right now, and we get all sorts of folks, including in one of those sessions. Last year it was here, this year it was up in Monterey with the fishery scientists to talk about the data, and it's a little different than this conversation. And we get feedback, we change the protocols. The hook and line is pretty well set now. We've been doing it for a couple years, but there have been modifications based on these discussions, and then we talk about how to use the data for management. So this just shows you, again, number of fishing days in 2007, 34, 5 vessels used, almost 8,000 fish caught and tagged, 174 volunteers that year for 366 volunteer days. Thank you, Leslie. And then in 2008, we increased our sampling, 48 days on the water, 10 vessels used, almost 10,000 fish caught, 218 volunteers for 484 volunteer angler days. So then this, we're getting people who come out multiple times. And I would imagine that you probably came out as much as anybody because you're here tonight. So there are people who come out a lot and want to go on these trips and participate. So here are some of the species that we catch: gophers, black and yellows, tree fish, China rockfish, brown rockfish, rosies and starry rockfish. These are all habitat, sort of demersal, which means they live on the bottom. They're very strongly associated with particular habitats, generally rocky high relief areas. And then you've got some kelp forest associated species like coppers and kelps and vermilions. And then some what we call semi-pelagics. They live up off of the bottom, things like black rockfish and blue rockfish and the olives and yellowtails, and of course the canary, which everybody talks about as well. Yes.
Quick question. Yeah. Are you seeing the tagged fish come up again? Has that?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that. We're seeing we're not seeing as many as we would like. We're getting right now fairly low tag returns. And we have a variety of explanations for that. Part of that is that, I think, part of that is that half of our area, you can't fish in. So our data, take the 20,000 fish that we've caught, half of those are in MPAs. You can't fish there anymore. And many of these are resident, meaning they don't move a lot. And some do move outside, but they are highly... they have a high site fidelity, many of the species, and so that's part of the reason. So we have fewer tagged fish functionally. And there could be, you know, I don't know exactly how to explain it. We'd like to see higher tag returns, and we need to mount a better tag return information program. We do give money, by the way, so just if you find a fish that has a tag, we pay you for it. And we don't even have to take the fish. We'd like to know where you caught it, and preferably if you have a GPS unit, we'd like to know right where you caught it. We'd like to know how big it is, and we certainly want to know what species it is. But you can still keep commercial fishermen up in the Monterey area, Año Nuevo, you know, north of there as well. And the fishery scientists, we had some really great discussions about modifications, but we're not going to just modify the gear and negate everything that we've done. We're actually going to do some focused experiments where we modify some of the traps and keep fishing the old traps as well to keep that continuity.
Okay.
And so it is a very important issue to modify gear. And unfortunately, in the hook and line, we haven't really had to modify anything that would that was that drastic that it would, you know, make the previous data from the previous year not usable. But if you do, then, you know, you're right. It's a trouble with consistency.
But then you can accommodate that.
Yes, and that we're going to do some focused experiments. I was just talking to a graduate student earlier today about this season. We're going to do some focused experiments to connect the modifications. And in fact, it's even better than that, because we have years of trapping data from work that we've done with Tom and Roger prior to the whole implementation of the MPAs. And so we spoke with the fishery scientists about this, and we've come up with an experiment to actually relate the trapping work that we've done before and the thousands of fish we have from that work to what we're doing now in the MPAs. It's not an ideal situation, but you can do some focused experiments to relate the data sets. And then a stock assessment person can use all of those additional data as well.
That's really exciting to think that you can go back and collect that data and utilize it, even though it might have been developed under different protocol.
Right. And you just, what you have to do is be able to compare the two protocols and find essentially a conversion factor for how they differ. So if you're looking at CPUE, how does this protocol differ from that one, fishing the exact same area? And once you have that statistically identified, then you can just use that conversion to relate the two data sets.
When you first started the collaborative...
Right. On the CPFV vessels?
Yeah. The Fish and Game discounted that to a certain extent because they didn't accept the protocol. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, I heard that a lot from the community, and that was very frustrating to people here. But then, I sat in the room with Steve Ralston and Alec and Deb Wilson Vandenberg from Fish and Game, and they talked about how that data set has been utilized multiple times for stock assessments. And so I don't know how the extent to which it's being used, but that data set, in conversations with the people doing the stock assessments, they're saying we are using that Fish and Game data set. Don, do you want to add something to that?
Let me just check in here. It's more of a process thing for where we are at the moment. There are four things we certainly want to do before we conclude tonight. One is to hear the results. Two, I think it would be great if we have just, if nothing else, a minute or if not more from the people who fish to tell us a little bit about their experience. And then there is an issue about whether or not the Marine Interest Group would like to request to reformulate a letter of support for continued funding for this kind of activity, because that's absolutely critical. We're going to have to go out to some new people who don't know as much about what we're doing. They're going to be interested in your point of view. And then, of course, we have to agree on the topics for the next session. So I just want to be sure we're managing across those different topics.
Great. I will finish up here very quickly. I think that was your very, very gracious and nice way of saying that. And, and so thank you. No hook here, but he's just sort of a verbal hook. All right. So let's get to the results. I'm going to show you Point Bouchon. Forget the other area, right? This is we're talking about our area right now. And I'm going to give you quick take-home messages from each of these graphs. You can see that these are species composition. This is Piedras Blancas, and this is Point Bouchon. And 2007 and 2008, here's a couple of things to take home. Well, first of all, gophers. Catch a lot of gophers. Almost 50% of the catch is gopher rockfish, followed by blues, lots of blue rockfish. Same thing up at... the lighthouse area, Piedras Blancas, in 2008, very similar with the absence of black rockfish here. The other thing I want to, an important point here is that, and this is something that's a takeaway here, and that is notice that this graph and the colors in this graph look very similar to this graph. That's important. That means that our sampling is consistent. We're seeing the same suite of species from year to year and in the same proportions. And so that means to me that, okay, this is good. This is a good, we're starting a good baseline. And if this shifts, we're going to be able to see it. All right? So that's the MPA, then the reference site. I'm not attributing this to the MPA, but what I'm identifying here is this consistency factor that we're going out the next year and we're getting the same patterns. That is the indication that we're starting to get a good baseline, that our protocols are working, and that we're starting to see repeatability in the data. So that's the take-home there. And again, looking at Point Bouchon, because it's our best example, we have 2 years of data. Again, black rockfish. This is mean length. And you see... Oh, hold on, that's not the one I wanted. The same thing, because it's the same graph. Wow. Consistency with PowerPoint. That's not showing it. Sorry, I'm trying to be efficient here and move through and show you the key points. That's Anya Nuevo. Here it is. This is CPUE. Catch per angler hour. So if someone sat over the boat for an hour, this is how many fish they would catch in an hour. And this is from 0 to 12. And notice, so let's go to gopher rockfish. You can't see that. I'm telling you that. This is in 2007 and 2008. So that's 2007, 2008. And if you come to the reference site 2007 and 2008 for gopher rockfish, you see that same exact pattern again. All I'm trying to emphasize here is we're seeing this consistency. We think the protocols, and for other reasons, we can do some statistics that show that our protocols are really working. That's an important point. Okay. So these are just fun, and I'm going to finish up here, Don, in the next couple of minutes. Catch by gear type for all areas. The two baits, the baited fly, just the fly, and the bar. This shows the percentage of catch of each of those gear types. It's very consistent, one-third, 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 both years, right? So we're learning something about these different gear types. That's interesting to a fisherman, certainly. Very consistent.
Because every fisherman thinks that it's
the other person's bait, that if they could only have that lure,
yes,
they would be successful. And what this is saying is it didn't really matter.
It didn't really matter, although it does matter in terms of what you catch. And so this is showing bar, bait, and fly. Bar, bait, and fly for lingcod. They're called lingcod bars for a reason. The fishermen know this. It's because you catch a lot of lingcod with them. And there are other species effects, like vermilion, bar, bait, and fly, so on and so forth. Some it doesn't matter. Certain species it does. And so that's kind of interesting information to see. There's a boat effect. So this is the Fiesta Pacific Horizon Patriot and Rita G. And there is a difference in these boats fishing the same areas. So is it the boat? Is it the captain? That's up for, you know, debate. But anyway, there is sometimes an effect of boat. And there is an angler effect also. This is the last one I'm going to show. So this is the average catch right here. This is the number of anglers that caught that. So these bars, this is the most number. What we find is that most people are in the middle. They catch about the average catch. But then there's always this person out here who catches about 35% what the normal angler does. Few people out here, and of course you four are out here, right? And then there's always this minus 60 person also. This is the person we want off the boat. But anyway, the great thing about this is it's what we call a normal distribution. It's random across angler abilities. That's an important thing, and we'll track that to make sure that we have this nice normal distribution. Some people are good, some people who are bad, most people who are in the middle. All right. So with that, I know we need to move on, and I would just like to acknowledge, of course, the science crew. This is just the science crew. We can't put all of the anglers' names, right? Hundreds of anglers. So all of the volunteer anglers, and then certainly the people who have funded this. And I think that this group also, again, this all grew out of the Marine Interest Group, and so we deserve some recognition as a community group for seeing how this has developed. So with that, I'll end and turn it back over to Don.
All right. So certainly invite some of our volunteer anglers. Does somebody like to just offer a brief comment? What was your experience like, just for a moment? We'll pass the microphone on to you. And just so they can get on camera, the back of your T-shirts.
Oh, yes. Turn around.
Yeah, there you are. The California Collaborative Fisheries Research Program. So thank you very much. Good. Thanks. We want to thank the hundreds, literally hundreds of people who came out and did all that important work. So one of the issues here for the Marine Interest Group in our on to the third of our four topics to finish off on here is just, you know, some reactions to this, your perception of the value. If so, I would invite the Marine Interest Group to consider, you know, putting forward a letter of support, in which case I'd like to just take a couple minutes, capture what you'd like as some key themes, and then as we've done in the past, I'll draft something up, send it out to you for review and back. But I'd like to first see, A, do you feel this is something you'd like to continue to support?
If so, what would be some themes you'd like the letter of support to highlight and see where we go from there? So first of all, the thought of, you know, what's the value here and what do you think? Yeah, Monica and Janice?
I have a thought on that, but I want to just make one comment to what we just saw. Dean, you mentioned that the time frame for this in terms of expecting to see some meaningful results is about 10 years. And I wanted to share with you...
I conveyed the time frame that was conveyed to me by the fishery scientists.
Right. And I realize that. Yeah. But I think the interesting point that struck me is that in research that I've done with commercial fishermen in looking at economic trends, we talked to fishermen from San Pedro to Monterey and asked them what the time frame was in terms of trying to understand economic effects of management of fisheries. Mm-hmm. That was their answer, too, that you had to look at least a 10-year period. So it suggests to me that the monitoring information of fisheries could easily coincide effectively with a time frame that I think fishermen would recognize and respect as a viable and a meaningful, informative look at what the economic impacts are. So that said, just an aside, but I think the work that you're doing, both in terms of pulling together the support and the funding that you have managed to deliver to this effort is just phenomenal because, as you know, this is really difficult and challenging and probably the hardest part of research. And there is so little monitoring that is going to be going on systematically that we should do everything we can to support continuing this because the baseline component of this relies on the idea that you're going to continue to cumulatively develop this information. So, of course, we would support that idea.
I'm going to second everything she said. I mean, it's so important, and we're getting the science, and this is where we can actually make decisions that are reasonable and livable. And so I just think it's amazing what you've already accomplished, and I love the cooperation that you're getting from the community. The fact that I think there's a recognition of the fact that, okay, we are trying to do this right now, and this is the first step. We've got to get the data to be able to make the decisions that are going to affect us for a long time to come. So I think we need to do everything we can to support this.
Yeah, I would add to that, you know, the fishing community here has just, with everything that I've observed over the limited number of years that I've been working here professionally, the last 8 or 9 years, it's just, it's tremendous to see the people that I interact with, their continual effort to try to do what's right and to see the fishing community really give an honest effort and you know, a sustained effort to see something happen. Even when it is, you know, their livelihood that's really directly impacted. So I think that it's very commendable, the Nature Conservancy work and the work that Henry's doing with the community. It's just, this community deserves a lot of credit, the fishing community here.
Well, and I think that's a recognition of the fact that they understand that you're doing this right. Mm-hmm. You know, they're getting the recognition of their knowledge, and it's being put to good use, put to scientific use that's going to be available to everybody. So it's a two-way street, and I'm really happy with the cooperation that's going on.
Other comments or observations?
I agree. We need to send that letter you proposed on. But I was wondering, is it the germane or province of this marine interest group to look into helping in finding sources of funding? Because I think looking to the state legislature is going to be a dry situation. And your idea about looking to NOAA or looking, after all, this is a laboratory that's going to have benefit for all the rest of the border states, I mean ocean states. Everybody ought to be interested in contributing to gathering this science and data information. So we shouldn't just look to the state of California. Federal government or federal agencies can help in funding this. I think it's worth their while.
And NOAA, I mean, they should see this report, I would think, to know that the results are happening.
Through a variety of mechanisms, both conversations. I'm actually going to be in D.C. in the middle of May, so in a couple of weeks here, and I hope to be visiting people in congressional offices to talk about the results. And when formal reports are written, we also provide those as well.
Dean, I think, and I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Kevin McCarthy, who's in a neighboring district, in fact, I think some of the people in this county are in his district, he's on a key Department of the Interior subcommittee that controls NOAA, or that somehow is connected to NOAA. And so he definitely is on one of the powerful committees that could have some influence on getting some funding through NOAA.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, Rick.
Were you trying to do, Carol? I'll find the mic.
Oh, I was just going to agree and to point out that if I remember correctly, two of the things that we identified early on as goals for this committee were to develop a valid and acceptable protocol so that the work would be accepted, and that would facilitate the development of baseline information. And those are things that are being accomplished, and those are things that have been identified for many, many years as being deficiencies in various studies, various environmental documents, and they're being addressed. And so it's critical that the funding be continued.
And I'm, of course, always going to come back with a caveat, and that is I agree. We're developing a baseline, and we have standardized protocols that have been vetted and reviewed, and that is a huge effort and a very positive thing. We're only working in state waters. This is the nearshore fishery. This is not where a lot of the commercial fishermen spend their time, right? So many of the commercial fishermen spend their time further out. And so we're not working there. I just wanted to, not that that's not a bad thing necessarily, but we're doing what we can given the resources we have and where we're working, and that is in the state waters.
Do you think that reduces the value to a national interest? Because you're developing...
Well, the nearshore fishery is an important fishery as well, and I don't think it diminishes. I think that the model that we just published that just got accepted in this fisheries journal, that model is transportable.
Okay.
Right.
So it still has national value.
Yes.
So any other comments Rick, you had
just
a comment?
A quick question for Dean. Is your data and protocols available on the SLOC website, so if somebody wants to go see more detail? Isn't it? Wasn't supposed to be a trick question.
Oh, I know. I'm sitting here thinking I should know every nook and cranny of that website. There is not a detailed protocol. Rick Starr and I are on the circuit to deliver the protocol to communities that are interested. And so we're doing that. We're giving them detailed protocols, and we're also giving presentations and talking with those people. So Fish and Game, we delivered the protocol. Obviously, they're doing our protocol. But I don't think there's not a detailed protocol on the website. That might be a good idea.
Let me just elaborate on that a little bit, because, Rick, I did speak with the Department of Fish and Game yesterday, and they want to put these protocols up on the Fish and Game website. And so that's going to be happening shortly.
Good. Oh, that's great news. You hadn't told me that.
And if you could put it on SLOC, I would do that too. I mean, I think transparency is great. There's always a suspicion that this will be somehow manipulated or unused in the future, and this is a great presentation. And just it's a lot of detail to catch. So if you can go and look at it on a website, that's a real good thing.
So we could put the presentation certainly on a website.
Yes.
And then, develop a file that describes all of the protocols in detail, and that certainly should go there as well.
So one more quick question, I hope. I thought that one would be quick. But
That was quick.
If stock assessments are critical to preserving future fishing access and our fishing businesses and access to local seafood. Would you be
caught, and they reduce that by 50% because the data is so poor that they're uncertain and they don't want to make a mistake. As they're starting to see this data, I've begun to hear in their conversations that this is opening a potential opportunity for them to look at reducing that discount level, which has the potential in areas where they feel they have more confidence in the information to potentially provide more fishing opportunity because they feel like they have better, more accurate information. Now, it may turn out the information comes back and says that there's fewer fish, they thought, but with more confidence. So, I mean, this can go both ways. This does not mean because we're getting the data that it's going to necessarily open up more fishing opportunity. But many people have said that in this area that they believe there to be more fish than the data available tend to provide information about. So to the degree that that's the case, and to the degree that Fish and Game becomes more confident about the uncertainty associated with the data, then the opportunities for them to be making adjustments in those uncertainty discounts, which are very significant, can potentially come into play. So that's no promise, but I am saying I'm hearing them on their own initiative after hearing these data and other research starting to talk about that. And I don't think they've ever talked about that before, at least Mel, and the discussions that you've had for years with them. I don't think that's been something that they've been initiating. So there are some opportunities ahead, and I think that's where there may be some things. So what I'll do is I'll sketch out a letter of support here, that's the understanding of the group. I'll get it out to you, and we'll make our best efforts to go forward with that. So, and thanks again, Dean, for the presentation and all the hard work, Leslie and Fisher, scientists, folks, and so on, for all that you've done. So the final thing here is to talk about the topics for next time. We do have a major discussion next time about the wave energy topic. That was the one that all of you agreed, or most all of you agreed, was an important issue. You want to hear about that. There is an OPC, California Energy Commission, report about the environmental and economic issues associated with wave energy. So there's a lot of things that are coming to a head on that, as well as the projects that are being proposed. So that'll be a major element with probably a multifaceted set of discussions around that topic. I'd like to entertain requests or suggestions about a second topic for the next time, which would be October 14th. That's our third of three sessions for the MIG. So things that you'd like to either offer or request that we find to address the issues. Rick is volunteering a topic that he'd like to offer.
If you can take suggestions for the peanut gallery, I'll try two. One is actually more time critical than I haven't mentioned before, but Margaret reminded me that in circulating that summary report on the monitoring, I think there was five areas, one of which was the socioeconomic monitoring, and the impact analysis was up here. A lot of us spent a lot of time. That's out there, I guess the report is, and it's just a very brief summary of it. I would love to hear a presentation for an impact analysis similar to Dean's on their baseline socioeconomic monitoring.
Oh, I mean, for the not just the things that SLOSI's done about its own area with the surveys locally, but socioeconomic thing is.
It's for the Central Coast.
Okay. I'd like to do is jot down a few of these and then sort of get a temperature and interest
just
reading from folks.
Put it on your list. I'll give you another one. I think at the last meeting, or the meeting before, it was came up as discussion on sea otter populations and sea otter counts, and I think that would be a great presentation. It wouldn't take that long to get somebody who's unbiased and has information on that, just to hear what the populations are, what the counts are, and trends and issues.
Okay. Other topics that are of interest. Henry.
No, I'd like to second Rick's comment or speak in support of Rick's suggestion on getting the information on the socioeconomic or sociocultural studies conducted by Impact Assessment, Inc. out of La Jolla.
Dean, do you know if there's anything, we're a constituent part of that baseline thing, to have any outreach of results from the investigators with interested audiences?
I know of no formal, you mean a Fish and Game sort of organized outreach effort?
Yeah, or any provisions in the contracts for the principal investigators to go out and
share
the
results? The only provision in the contracts was that we had to provide data to the data sets to Fish and Game. Entire data sets.
But nothing on the outreach side.
But nothing on the outreach
side. Okay, but we could explore that to see if that might be the case.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know some of those
folks? We have someone on staff who was part of that.
Space Marine Resource Management in the context also of the MPA planning process for federal waters of the sanctuary. And we have been getting some very positive feedback in that regard and are looking at some pretty exciting ideas that we are trying to flesh out. We're hoping that that will be accomplished in time for a presentation to the Pacific Fishery Management Council at their September meeting. And if there's an interest, we would be happy to present that that roadmap at your October meeting.
Okay. All right. Let me just sample if there are any other topics that you'd like to bring up. Okay. So if we were to pick... I think what we need is probably a lead one and a backup one because we don't know if we can get the right people on these particular things here. We already have the wave energy one lined up. So let me just get, if you were to pick one, how many of you would pick the socioeconomic impact as the lead one? One, two, three, four. Oh, okay, everybody. All right. And if you were to pick up... If you pick a backup, which of these two, Sea Otters or the what the sanctuaries and PFMC or so on are doing on the MPAs as being a topic? So how many of you would pick Sea Otters? One, two, three, four, five. How many of you would pick this? One, two, three. Okay, so I'll figure that this is the main one we'll go for. We'll have this as a second choice. And Mike, maybe I can work with you and we can get either some summary or just make it as an update rather than a major discussion item so that people can be informed about it but yet recognize the priority that's...
Yeah, I just want to say I voted for the Sea Otters, but I am interested in the other topic too, so it can always be another our next meeting.
Yeah.
So.
Or find a way to give you, you know, a five-minute version of this, if we could ever do anything in 5 minutes, which is hard.
Don't get me up there.
Right. So with that, I think you've really done an outstanding job here collectively in addressing the issues for this evening. Our next meeting is going to be October 14th, 6 to 9 p.m. here at the same location, and I just want to do our standard, Dean always loves this, our standard word of the day. So just one word to sort of capture where you think we are about the work that's being done. And PJ, you've got a word on your mind. I can see that on your face.
I hate when he makes me do just one word.
Well, take two.
Okay, dynamic.
Okay.
Go.
Hopeful.
Okay. Carolyn.
What was yours, PJ?
Dynamic.
Mine is progress.
Okay. Mel.
Encouraged.
Okay. Janice.
She said helpful.
Helpful, okay.
Long running.
I don't mean the media.
You meant the effort is long running.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mine is always the same. Collaboration.
Data.
Champagne.
And my word, as always, is thankful. Thankful to you, all of you, for volunteering your time and effort and the public in your interest and everyone's efforts to help move these initiatives forward. Thank you so much.